Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Well, Matt, here we are, Thrive Deeper, our fortnightly Bible study and continuing in the book of Genesis. Welcome, listeners. Great to have you with us. Last episode, Matt, I think we got to the end of chapter 23, kind of where Abram's wife passed away. He bought a field in which to bury her. And we're moving into chapter 24 of the story of Abraham and his family and Isaac, obviously, as we now move into chapter 24, where Abraham is concerned about finding a wife for Isaac.
It's interesting that Isaac is a fairly minor character in these stories. We don't get much about Isaac, but it's interesting the amount of space that this story gets, which actually isn't Isaac is not a lead character. It's actually this servant.
No, that's right.
And you wonder, why is this story given so much space? So there's something important here about the fact that he's finding a wife from amongst his own people. Now, this becomes a very important theme later on, the theme of not intermarrying with the people because of the danger of idolatry is a central theme throughout the Old Testament narratives, because holiness is a central theme, and holiness means separateness. So you've got to be separate. So don't mix, intermarry. Mixing with the people was crossing that holiness boundary. You're to be set apart.
Yeah.
It's not that they were to have necessarily nothing to do with the people as such, but intermarriage was a certain kind of bond.
It's the term we would use these days to unequally yoked. Don't be unequally yoked, because your priorities, and remember, this is an incredibly spiritual, we tend to think that in our context, not many people are very spiritual, let's just say, but in this day and age, everyone had a god or gods of some kind.
Yeah.
So if it isn't going to be the god that you're going to worship, if you marry into some other group of people, that's going to be their gods.
That's right.
So it was really important.
Yeah, that's right. So I think that's why this is given a lot of space, because it is important. But there's another reason. I think it shows how God's providence is at work in all of this. So we have these constant signs of verse 7, he will send his angel before you so that you can get a wife from my son from there, Abraham says to his servant. Then verse 12, the servant prays, Lord God of my master Abraham, make me successful today. And then, of course, he does make him successful. And then down in verse 27, the servant who's not named here bows down and worships when he finds, he just happens to come upon that exact family.
Yes.
And, you know, he says, praise be to the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not abandoned his kindness and faithfulness to my master. As for me, the Lord has led me on a journey to the house of my master's relatives. You know, you don't have Google Maps or anything, so getting, even finding the place is a big job.
Yeah.
I mean, getting there safely, one, then finding them and coming across this family who they've been separated from for decades and decades. You know, this is quite remarkable.
Yeah. And the fact that his servant, you know, again, and this demonstrates the way the household serves the God of the master, and the servant recognizing that and then, you know, genuinely paying homage and respect to the God of his master.
That's right. So that's the main purpose of that story. And it's after that that we get the account of the death of Abraham.
Yes.
So this is also provision for Abraham's descendants, which is a key theme here, is that, you know, your family is going to be these mediators of blessing, and they're going to be like, the number of them will be like the stars in the sky and the sand and the seashore. And so Isaac finding a wife and the right kind of wife is important. Yep. And then, of course, we have the death of Abraham. But we're told, interestingly, that after Sarah's death, Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. And she bears him a number of sons, including Midian. That's worth noting, because the Midianites are going to come up in the next book of the Bible in Exodus. So Moses is going to end up with the Midianites when he escapes from Pharaoh, and he's going to be living amongst them. He's going to marry a Midianite woman. So the Midianites, remember them.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
There we go. So so Midian is a descendant of Abraham. There's a little section here about Ishmael's sons, and you might find it curious that it mentions anything about this? Why are we to care about this? This is important because it's a little fulfillment moment, because we're told that he has these sons and these become the names of the 12 rulers. And in Genesis 17:20, God had said to Abraham, "As for Ishmael, I have heard you, I will surely bless him and make him fruitful and will greatly increase his numbers. He will be the father of 12 rulers and I will make him a great nation." So this is a little, this little cul-de-sac here that doesn't go any further than this. This is the last we hear of Ishmael. But we're told, well, we hear about Ishmaelites later on, but this is the last we hear of Ishmael. So this is just closing. There are these moments that just close off these characters. Wherever a promise has been made, the sequence is always, if there's a "and God said," there's always a "and it was so." This is the "and it was so" story that just shows that Ishmael has been blessed and God's promises have been fulfilled.
It was good and interesting at the same time, and I hadn't noticed it in previous readings of this, that Ishmael was actually there with Isaac to bury Abraham, to bury their father.
Yeah,
you kind of felt like, apart from that passage, which felt like it was just talking about him in the third person in a sense, but he was actually there and buried with Isaac, buried Abraham, which I thought was encouraging. Maybe they stayed in contact. We don't really know.
But yeah, get the same actually at the death of Isaac. Jacob and Esau together go and bury their father. So that's something that continues.
So then Jacob and Esau.
Yeah, this story gets a lot of space. This is essentially the story of Jacob. Having heard so little about Isaac, it's interesting that we have a massive section about Jacob. This takes up, it's probably the biggest story in the book of Genesis. And it's important because Jacob is the one from whom the nation of Israel gets their name. Of course, Jacob is renamed Israel. So he stands, in a sense, as a prefiguration of the nation. In fact, things that are going to happen to him is going to look very much like the history of his nation.
Yeah.
And this is important because Jacob is not really an exemplary character, Stu. You may have noticed that.
And in fact, you know, it's somewhat encouraging, let me just say at the start, because you realize how we all know how far short we fall. Yet here's a guy who I'd have to say, even though I know I'm far from a perfect person, you kind of go, why on earth is God blessing this guy? You
know, I know.
It's like, it is, you know, but that's exactly the point of a lot of these stories.
Yeah. I remember reading this to my son, Jeremiah, and how incensed he was when we got, as, you know, God was blessing Jacob. And Jeremiah was just getting angry and angrier, my son, Jeremiah.
Yes.
Because this is not fair. He's a bad guy and bad people shouldn't get blessed.
Yes.
And I think original readers, I think, would have responded in the same way, because there is this sense, you know, good people get blessed and bad people get cursed, and that's how it works. But this is actually a story of grace, and God has made a promise to this family. And so you see God's commitment. God is the good one here through this story, not Jacob. You know, I think that's really important, because what we're meant to draw from these stories is the faithfulness of God despite the unfortunate machinations of people. And there are moments of trust, absolutely moments of trust. There are moments where good things happen.
Yeah.
But on the whole, Jacob is not the most exemplary character. But as you say, I've found this enormously edifying to just go through this again and see how God persisted with Jacob.
Yeah.
You know,
it's actually quite a story of a dysfunctional family, really. It's not just Jacob, but, you know, in some ways, there's dysfunction all the way through there. So there's hope for us.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, so we hear that Rebekah comes back, obviously. At the time, Isaac was 40 years old. He took Rebekah, the sister of Laban.
Because Laban's going to turn up
again
in the story. So it's that background of the servant going up back to Haran, and essentially Jacob's going to go back there as well.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, actually, the trajectory of this story, because any form of going back is a reversal. Let's just keep that in mind.
Yes.
Yeah, that's important. And so coming to the land was a very key and important part of the call of Abraham. So we're just going to keep that in mind as we go through this story.
So interestingly, again, Rebekah turns out to be barren. And so Isaac prays to the Lord on her behalf and heard his prayer, and his wife Rebecca conceived. Turns out she was having twins, and for whatever reason she sensed they were fighting inside of her, and so she inquired of the Lord, and he said to her, and this is in chapter 25, verse 23, two nations are in your womb, two people will come from you and be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger.
So yet again, God is flipping things here, and he's choosing the younger over the older, which is yet another thing that goes against the customs of the time. So again, you know, the grace, there's this theme of grace here. This is the one that deserves it doesn't get what they deserve, but the one who seemingly is undeserving is the one that gets the blessing. And when I say the blessing, is the one that continues the family, the line of blessing in particular. So God chooses the younger.
And tells that to Rebecca, obviously. So she gives birth. And
it's, Stu, I think it's important to notice that. So God has announced this up front.
Yes, he has.
And it's interesting because Jacob is going to try, so the children are born, and Jacob is going to try to secure this blessing in his own way. So there's a very interesting theme here about how Jacob's deceptiveness and his machinations are going to work with God's sovereignty, because God had already promised that that was going to be the case.
Yeah. And well, yet, I kind of also read it as Rebecca trying to help God, because as we get into the story, it was God who revealed that to her. Yeah. And she's going, hang on, this doesn't seem to be going to plan.
Yeah.
And anyway, let's not jump too far ahead.
Yeah.
Where do we want to pick up? When Esau sells his birthright. So just explain birthright a little bit to us, Matt.
Yeah. So the birthright was basically all property was passed on to the eldest son, and the eldest son was the one that was then responsible for the clan. So he became the clan leader, and the clan being the broader family. So the younger siblings and their families, they would all live together in a clan, but the eldest sibling would be the one that basically was in charge of everything. So the birthright is passing on all of the possessions to that eldest child,
right,
and they would then manage those and look after everyone
else. The family.
Yeah.
And Esau and Jacob, quite different personalities, quite different physically as well. Esau, the sort of the real manly, let's just say, hunting kind of love to get out in the outdoors.
Yep.
Jacob, a bit more of the computer geek, like to be, in his room playing games or whatever it might be. You know,
bit of a mummy's boy, I think he
completely,
was.
Yeah. Completely different. But also you can understand maybe why, from Rebecca's point of view, because she was aware of what God had told her about Jacob. And so Esau comes in, he's been out hunting, and he says to his brother Jacob, I'm starving, dying of hunger here, give me some of that stew you're cooking. So obviously Jacob was a good cook, and Jacob replied to him, first sell me your birthright, which seems like an odd answer. And I wonder whether this was kind of in jest. Esau comes in and goes, oh man, I'm starving, give me some of that stuff there. And Jacob replies, yeah, sure, sell me your birthright, kind of thing. And then Esau says, I'm about to die, I'm starving here, so what good is the birthright to me anyway? And so Jacob then insisted that he swear to me first. So he swore to Jacob and sold his birthright to him. And then Jacob gave bread and lentil stew to Esau. He ate, drank, got up, and went away. So Esau despised his birthright. And I think that last little sentence is probably a key one here.
Yeah, it is a key one. He doesn't really take this seriously. So I think Jacob is probably aware. I mean, his mother, I'm sure, will have communicated to him what God had revealed to her. So again, this is the helping God thing. So Jacob is the first one here to think, this is my moment. I can leverage this moment. So I think there probably was some seriousness about this. You know, he's going to manipulate this moment to his advantage here. You know, so he draws that from his brother. Then we leave them. It's interesting here because you expect then we're going to keep going with this story. But then we have a story, the only other story really about Isaac. And it's interesting how similar this story is to a couple of stories of Abraham. In fact, with the same Abimelech in one case.
Although it may not be the same Abimelech. It may just be a son called the same name, which they often did, of course.
So again, he's given the promise. There's a famine in the land. He's going to leave the land. He's going to go down to. So he's about to follow, pretty much do what Abraham did. So
go to Egypt.
God says, no, don't go down there. Yeah. I'm going to bless you. I'll look after you. That's important because when he goes to the Philistines, he's afraid that, again, his wife is going to be taken from him. So he lies. He says, she's my sister. And this guy, Abimelech, sees them having an intimate moment, says, mate, you lied to me. What are you doing here? And again, you know, he didn't need to lie because God had said, I'm going to bless you. So you see this same sort of pattern, like father, like son.
Yeah. But also just the awareness of Abimelech, you know, probably because the story had been passed down to him about what potentially happened with Abraham. He was seriously concerned about, as you say, the judgment or the curse coming on him if that had happened and it wouldn't have been his fault again, which is what the last Abimelech said. I think just one other important thing to point out just before we got to that passage towards the end is God really spells out again the covenant at verse 4. I will make your offspring as numerous as the stars of the sky. Mm. I will give your offspring all these lands and all the nations of the earth will be blessed by your offspring.
Yeah, so with each generation, there's a reaffirmation of that promise. It's actually very important in the text to note that. Because this promise is being passed down through the generations and God's faithfulness is with Abraham and his children, just like God said.
Yeah.
So this is the reaffirmation of this promise is reaffirming God's commitment to this family line.
Yeah.
We see that actually because we're told in verse 12 of chapter 26 we're in now that he planted crops in the land. He reaps a hundredfold because the Lord blessed him. His wealth increases. Abimelech, in the end, says, you need to move away from us. They're getting nervous about how powerful he's becoming. Stu, this is another theme, this idea that God's blessing brings some opposition as well. There's a sense of they're being blessed, they're becoming more powerful, and people become a bit paranoid about that. This happens right the way through the story of the Bible, the story of Israel in the Bible, you know, this sense.
Look at the Pharisees and the Sadducees when Jesus was here.
That's a big theme. So he moves away, and again, he goes to Beersheba down south. God appears to him again, reaffirms the promise, I'm going to bless you for the sake of Abraham. In other words, for the sake of the promise I made to Abraham. So we get this. Yeah. So that's a, you know, interesting moment there where we get this reaffirmation of the promise to Isaac, despite the fact that he has this moment of a lapse of faith. Mm. Yet the overall account is emphasizing the fact that despite that, God is saying, I'm going to bless you.
I'm really faithful, even if you're not.
That's right. Yeah. No, that's good.
So then he has to make a covenant with Abimelech. Abimelech comes out actually and meets him because he's worried now. Isaac's continuing to flourish where he is away from them. And so they make a bit of a treaty, I guess, in a sense to say, here's a boundary. Let's agree that you won't mess with us and we won't mess with you.
Which is a sign of the blessing because you only make a covenant with equals. And, you know, the Philistines were a powerful ancient people. So this really says something, the fact that this clan is now can hold its own beside the most powerful people in the land. So that's significant. It's just one generation from Abraham and already there's this relationship of equality with the people in the land. So very significant.
So then, Matt, we get this right at the end of chapter 26, we get this interesting little one sentence really, or one verse 34 and 35 actually, that kind of I think we can skip over, but I actually think sows into so much of what we have happened in the time ahead and speaks back to what you talked about before when they went to look for Isaac's wife, they went back to the original people because it says here, when Esau was 40 years old, he took as his wives Judith, daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basemath, daughter of Elon the Hittite. Mm. They made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah.
Yeah, and the reason why, because they'd gone to so much trouble to ensure that, you know, they married within their own people, and yet Esau seems to, again, just show no respect for this. So,
and it seems to me with Esau, just very quickly, that, you know, the whole giving up his birthright, this here, it seems like he really didn't pay much attention to the heritage.
Yeah, doesn't
or to
care.
Abraham and Isaac's kind of what would have been passed down. It's like, whatever. You know, in a sense, it feels like that.
Yeah, so this somewhat vindicates. I mean, I know that what Jacob does isn't good, but you know, neither is Esau. There's no real good people in this story. I mean, no one in this story is really particularly deserving. But yeah, you certainly see that Esau really doesn't care about his heritage as such. So chapter 27 is the story of the deception of Isaac. And it's worth pointing out that Jacob's name at birth, because he came out grasping the heel. Grasping the heel is a Hebrew idiom for deceiver.
Right.
So his name indicates right from the start what sort of person he's going to be, which is far from flattering, given that the only other character in the Bible that's called deceiver is the devil. So it flags the fact that this, you know, this, we're not dealing with a good guy here. Now, his name is going to be important later because God's going to change his name. So he, in this story, certainly lives up to his name. So Isaac, he's getting old. He's actually going to live 20 or more years. But at this stage, he thinks that he's dying and he's going to bestow the deathbed blessing upon his eldest son. Now, again, it's interesting, Stu, how much space this story is given. And it puts a lot of emphasis on this practice of the deathbed blessing, which is, again, is hard for us to understand in our cultural context. A deathbed blessing is something that once bestowed, it can't be retracted. You bestow your deathbed blessing, and that's...
Yeah, you can't kind of go, oh, actually, sorry.
No, you can't. Because it's seen to be efficacious. It's, you know, once that blessing is given, it's out there.
Irrevocable.
That's right. So Rebecca knows this. He tells Esau, go out, get me some food, come back and I'll give you my blessing. Rebecca sees the chance. She says...
I need to help God out here. This is going wrong.
Yeah, that's right. This is not going the way it's meant to go because this is meant to be Jacob, the younger, that gets this. This is what God had promised. So she comes up with this plan, tells Jacob to dress up like his brother and basically deceive Isaac and receive the blessing, which he does. And it's very emphatic the way that he, because Isaac, when Jacob comes into him dressed up like Esau, he hears his voice and he thinks, this is not my, this is.
Yeah, that's right.
This is like the voice of Jacob. I mean, and so, you know, he asks him, who is this? And he says, I am Esau. So he lies to his father. And, you know, he's really consciously doing, and then he even says, you know, are you really Esau?
Yes.
And yes again. So he's really lying.
Yeah,
he's really lying here. So this isn't good in a context, you know, of covenant making and interposing yourself like this in this cultural context is really bad thing to do.
Yeah, totally.
You know,
I mean, even went to the lengths, because Esau was a bit of a hairy fellow and Jacob wasn't really, of covering his arm in case Isaac said, let me touch you, kind of thing. Put Esau's clothes on, so he even smelt like, goes to a lot of trouble to do this. But the interesting thing here is that when his mother, Rebecca, suggests that he does this, he says, suppose my father touches me, then I will seem to be deceiving him and I'll bring a curse rather than a blessing on myself. So he understands the curse and the blessing thing here. And his mother says to him, your curse be on me, my son, just obey me and go get them for me. So, and again, I feel for Rebecca, that she was really trying to protect God's, what he told her, thinking she had to step in and help God out here. You know?
Which is, again, there's a little bit, there's repetition here, because we saw this with Sarah and Hagar and saying, hey, it isn't working out, we're going to help God out, do this. So you get this same sort of theme here. You know, repetition is important.
And again, we see it later as well.
Yeah. So, you know, moral of the story. There's not always a moral to the story, but if there was, it would be, don't help God. He doesn't need your help. Cooperate with God. You don't need to make it happen.
Can I know we're trying to push through here, but one thing that seemed evident to me, it's interesting that Sarai was barren. Rebecca was barren. It's almost as though God's saying, I'm wanting to be really clear that this is me, not you. And you look at so many times through the biblical history or narratives, you know, look at Jericho, for instance. Joshua was probably a really well-equipped military general at the time, but God got him to do something so ridiculous, so there was no way Joshua could claim that was him. And I think this is, again, where we jump in and try to fix things, but God just actually wants to show us that there's no obstacle that can stop him.
And it doesn't go well, Stu, because and the theme of the tension between brothers, right from Cain and Abel, of course, is another common theme throughout Genesis. So straight away, he has to flee because his brother is going to kill him. His brother's a powerful man.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really work out. Rebecca sends him back to his uncle to take shelter there until, you know, Esau calms down, which he doesn't really do.
No.
You know, she says, I'll go like a few days, as though it's going to be a few days.
Yeah.
But actually, he's going to be there for 20 years.
Yeah.
She says, I'll send you word when you can come back. She never really does. I mean, after 20 years, it's actually God that tells him to come back.
Yeah, that's right.
But the important thing about this is exile, Stu. This is Jacob. And just think about the trajectory of the story of Israel in the Old Testament. This is Jacob going out of the promised land into exile, following the similar path to what the Jewish exiles did. So having deceived and done what was clearly the wrong thing.
Yes.
So this very much looks like a prefiguration of the story of Israel. So he flees, he goes essentially into exile. He's going to go and live with his uncle Laban. Laban is just as sort of wily and deceptive.
Mm. I think Jacob's going to get a taste of his own medicine.
He is going to get a taste
anyway.
Of his own medicine. But while he's on the way, you know, he's fleeing. Now, think about this. With the clothes on his back and his stuff, I mean, this guy is, he ends up with nothing. He's on his own here. No one else is with him. This is
He hasn't been married at this point in time.
Not married. This is a forlorn figure.
Yeah.
So this is a real low point. And he's driven from his home. He's on his own traveling this distance, which is quite dangerous. So at this bottom of the barrel moment, right, he's done all his deceiving and all of that. And it's just ended up a shipwreck. And it's at this point that God comes and meets Jacob.
Yes.
This is the moment, right? And he has this dream, and he has a dream of angels.
Jacob's ladder story.
Jacob's ladder or the stairway with angels up and down. So the angels are being deployed to his benefit, right? You know, God is deploying angels to protect him and to ensure that God's purpose is realized through him. And he sees this in his dream, and he gets this promise. Again, the promise is reaffirmed to Jacob as it was to Isaac and as it was to Abraham, right? So this is the next generation now receiving the promise. At an important moment, as he's on his way into exile, where it seems like
the complete opposite.
The guy that's meant to carry the promise is actually going into exile.
Yes.
So how's this going to work? Well, on his way there, he has this dream. He's going to be protected, and he's still going to be blessed, and he's going to have descendants and so forth. I mean, the interesting thing here is that because he is going back to his family, he's going to marry again within his own people.
Yes.
Unlike Esau, he's not going to marry the people of the land. So, you know, there is an element of providence in this.
Well, Isaac, just before he left, summoned him and said, don't take a wife from the Canaanite
woman. That's right,
Go and marry one of your uncle's
daughters. That is the kind of, I mean, because in order for Rebecca to send her son away, she does need Isaac's
approval.
Mm. And so this is done in the name of getting a wife, but actually he has to flee to escape his brother.
Totally get it.
So it's interesting his response though, Stu, because...
Well, first of all, he acknowledges what an amazing place this is and makes an altar and calls the place, which we now know as Bethel. But then this interesting kind of bargain almost he tries to strike.
Yeah, not a great moment. Then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I'm taking, will give me food and clothes and so that I return safely to my father's household, then the Lord will be my God.
Mm.
Mm. And this stone I've set up as a pillar of God will be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a tenth. You know, it's the if then that's the problem. I just said I will. So not a great moment of faith there.
No.
Interestingly, just the detail here, that again, as we had with Abraham, Abraham gave a tenth of the plunder to Melchizedek.
Mm.
And here with Jacob also part of his offering of worship is to give a tenth back to God. So this is
pre-Mosaic law too.
Yeah, this is pre-Mosaic law. So this seems to be a very core principle of worship is actually as a response to God's blessing is giving back a tenth to God of what he gives to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he takes the journey like the servant that went to get Rebecca.
Yeah.
He comes across the people.
Yes.
Again, the patterning of these stories, similar sorts of things happen. Rachel comes along, as he's at the well with the shepherds.
Yeah.
You know, he sees her, he falls in love with her.
It's like a movie scene.
It's like a movie scene, right? Yep. So very similar, right? Mm. Similar to the story of the servant getting Rebecca from in the same area. So he falls in love, asks to marry this girl. Laban says, okay, you're going to work for 7 years for me and then you can have her. He serves 7 years.
Mm.
The time comes for the wedding and they have a big party. No doubt he gets drunk, Stu. He goes, you know, out to the tent where they're going to consummate. Who he thinks is Rachel comes out to the tent.
Yes.
Right. He's drunk. It's kind of pitch dark. They consummate the marriage and he wakes up in the morning and it's not her.
No, it's Leah, her sister.
It's Leah, older sister, because Laban wants to, you know, marry off the older sister before the younger. But he's also going to get another 7 years of work out of Jacob because now, if you want to marry Rachel, yeah, you can marry her, but you'll need to work another 7 years. The point here, Stu, is that he's essentially, Jacob ends up as a sort of bond slave in the household of Laban. So again, same idea, going into, he's into exile. He ends up in a kind of bond slavery to his uncle. Yes, he gets married there, but it's not a great situation.
No.
And yet...
And I wonder whether Laban wanted them to stay. We don't know, but I wonder whether he wanted them to stay because he knew about the blessing. This man's going to be blessed. If I hang around him, I'm going to reap the benefit of that blessing.
Yeah.
I don't know, but he seemed very keen and even towards the end, still keen to keep him there as long as he possibly could.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. But by the way, the working for... just a detail here, the working for Rachel, Jacob offers this, but there is the expectation of a bride price.
Yes.
And the bride price would actually, in that culture, you would pay a bride price which would be held by the family. In case the bride became a widow, that bride price would then support
her,
the bride, if she became a widow. Now, that's going to be an issue later because they're going to accuse their father of this. So basically, he was, when Jacob worked for him, he was meant to store up the wages.
Yes.
That was their money, right?
As though he was paying him, Jacob, but instead of paying Jacob, he was putting it in the bank essentially for them in case.
Yeah. That's right. And so that was kind of their insurance money, let's say.
Yes, yes.
Now, Laban actually is not going to do that. So they're going to accuse him later on of having spent their insurance money, as it were. So he works this other 7 years for Rachel.
Yes.
And this is, unfortunate, such an element of cruelty in this for Leah, who is pushed into this situation. Mm. She's this unloved wife, but God favors her.
Here we go.
Yet again.
The Hagar thing
that's
again.
That's right. It's the Hagar thing again. But God favors her, right? Mm. God sees. Verse 31 of chapter 29, when the Lord saw Leah, as you say, it's the same with Hagar, that God is the God who sees me. Here is this neglected, unloved, relatively unimportant character, but God sees them. Mm. God blesses her. God has compassion for her. Mm. She is actually going to become the mother of most of Jacob's children.
Yes.
I mean, Rachel is going to have two sons, but she's going to have a number of sons. There's a couple of handmaids here
as well in the
mix, which is, I know, a little weird because the next account is the account of Jacob's children. Mm. And so we have Reuben, Simeon, and Levi and Judah. And, you know, Rachel sees that she's not bearing children. So
again, another barren woman, which is interesting.
Another, yes, that's
and
right.
God's promise, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Another barren woman. So important theme. So she gives her handmaid, a servant, Bilhah.
Sounds familiar.
To Jacob. Again, yes, familiar thing. It's like,
let's help God out again.
Let's help God out again. And she has Dan, Naphtali, and then Leah, who stopped having children, she takes her servant.
Yes.
Zilpah.
It's almost like a competition.
Yeah, it's a competition, yeah. And she gives her servant to Jacob as a wife. Mm. I mean, Jacob's just seems to go along with all of this. And she has Gad and then Asher. It gets worse because then there's this moment where Reuben is out in the field and he comes back with some mandrake plants.
Yes.
And Rachel, who's still unable to have children, says to Leah, give me some of your son's mandrakes. And what's the big deal here? Well, mandrakes, there was a bit of superstition around mandrakes, mandrake plants in the ancient world. They were thought to be a
fertility kind of.
It was a bit of a fertility thing.
Symbol.
Yeah,
exactly.
So again, This is still grasping for answers rather than trusting God. So she buys, it's so weird.
It is weird. It's she can have Jacob, she says to Leah.
Yeah.
You can sleep with him tonight in exchange for your son's mandrakes.
But then we hear that God listened to Leah, not to Rachel. So Rachel's grasping for the superstitious answer.
Yes.
For this in the mandrakes. But we're told in verse 17 that God listened to Leah and she became pregnant, bore Jacob a fifth son, Issachar. She conceives again.
Yeah.
So this is, and she has Zebulun. So this is, God is favoring Leah through all of this. It's important that there's a buffer because it's not the mandrakes. The mandrake thing doesn't work. It's actually, we're told in verse 22, finally, that God remembered Rachel and he listened to her. You know, God is being faithful to Rachel here, and she has Joseph.
Totally. And just before we move on from there, a couple of things that'll be important to know for later. Leah also bore a daughter named Dina, who will come into the story a little later. Leah's kind of heart really was, because she says it many times, now I've borne Jacob a son, surely he will love me. And yet, of course, that wasn't going to happen because Jacob loved
Rachel. So we have Joseph. Joseph is going to become the lead character in the next, the next story. And, you know, and again, he is going to be the one who's going to lead, essentially lead the family. And he's the younger. Mm. He's the younger brother. He's actually the second youngest because Rachel's going to have another child, Benjamin.
Mm.
Anyway, it gets to this point where he serves the 14 years for the two wives. And he says, right, let me go. Send me on my way so I can go back to my homeland. Interesting that he needs permission for this. Laban really has authority here. Laban doesn't want to let him go because he sees that God's blessed him because of Jacob. Very interesting that he recognizes this. But he also says, I've learnt this by divination. You know, Laban is very much a pagan. Remember, God appeared to Abraham, leave your father's household, right? Yeah. Leave that household. So they're all pagans.
Yes.
And I mean, we hear about household gods later. So we've just got to remember that. They're not worshippers of Yahweh. He's living amongst pagan relatives here.
Yeah.
So he's learnt by divination that God is blessing him because of Jacob, which is an important theme because in the Joseph story, we're going to see that God blessed Potiphar's household because Joseph was there as a servant, right?
Yes.
He was a slave in the household, and yet God blessed the whole household because he was there. So you get the same thing with Joseph. You get the same thing, in fact, with many characters. You know, Daniel, for example, was a blessing to the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar. So this idea of being the one that mediates the blessing is an important, this is an important fulfillment moment because he's part of that household. He brings blessing to that, to that household.
That's great.
So he understands this.
And Laban sort of says, name your wages and how much will it cost me for you to stay?
Yeah. So.
And then there's an interesting story about sheep and goats.
I was just thinking about what to say about this.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they make this deal where Jacob is going to take all the speckled goats. So either they're normally, the sheep are normally white and the goats are normally black.
Yeah.
Speckled color is very, very rare. Now, Jacob, well, he says later that God revealed to him a way in which he could breed in such a way to, and look, you know, I mean, modern eugenics can explain how this works, but Laban doesn't know this.
Yeah.
So he thinks, oh, this is great.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to end up with nothing. Not only that, but actually Laban takes the speckled animals out so that there's no, so that all Jacob has to work with is
the white,
is the black or the white, right? Because he thinks, well, they're just going to continue to have black or white. So again, Laban's trying to cheat. Yet again, he's trying to cheat Jacob out of his, you know, so this, this idea of Laban cheating Jacob, and in fact, in similar ways, because going back to the story of sending in Leah rather than Rachel, this is one sister pretending to be another sister. It was exactly what Jacob had done by pretending to be his brother. You can very much see that this is
reap what you
Jacob
sow.
is kind of reaping what he's sown here. Mm. And so yet again here, Laban's trying to deceive him. But the interesting thing here is that God still gives him success.
Yes.
So Laban, the deceiver, doesn't get the better of him and he ends up.
However he does it, he ends up with lots of speckled flocks.
And then he flees. And we get in chapter 31, Stu, we get essentially a kind of repetition of the call to Abraham in verse 3. Yeah. Then the Lord said to Jacob, go back to the land of your fathers and to your relatives and I will be with you. So this is his, this is him in Haran. This is like starting again, right, go. Like just as he said to Abraham, now go, go back. So remember, Rebecca hasn't called for him.
No.
She said, I'll send for you,
I'll
when,
let
it's
you
safe.
Know when it's safe.
I'll let you know when it's safe. Mm. So it's not safe because he hasn't got the word from Rebecca, but God is saying, I'll be with you. That's the point. He goes to leave. I mean, he has to essentially escape. He escapes when Laban's back is turned. He takes his wives. He consults them, you know, says, look, this is because they have to want to leave. This is a big thing for them. They say, he spent our insurance, like I was saying before, right?
Yeah, so they say,
he's left us with nothing.
Verse 14, do we have any portion or inheritance in our father's household? Are we not regarded by him as outsiders? For he has sold us and has certainly spent our money.
Yeah, that's right. So that's what I was referring to before. Yeah.
They're happy to go.
So they take off. He realizes that they've gone. It's interesting too, because they take the household gods.
Rachel does.
Rachel takes the household gods. Mm. Why does she do this? I think...
So I mean, Jacob took what he was entitled to in terms of the flocks and no more.
Yeah.
But Rachel, for some reason...
There's some suggestion that taking the household gods is perhaps taking your bit of a birthright thing.
Okay.
That the household gods went to the child who inherited the birthright.
Right.
So the right of the firstborn. And so is she kind of taking this... We don't know exactly. She's taking it, you know, so...
Or were they worth something? Was there some money in there? It's kind of like, man, you didn't give us any inheritance, so we're going to take these? Don't know.
Probably
gold?
Not. Yeah, probably not. It's more the perceived value. Was this maybe just out of spite for a father? I'm just going to take this.
Or hedging bets.
Gods? That's right. I think it could well have been that. I'm just going to take these household gods to hedge our bets.
We don't know.
You know, from Rachel, and when Laban pursues, he realizes they've gone, he pursues them. Mm. God appears to him. I mean, Laban's going to come down heavy-handed on Jacob. God appears to him in a dream and says, just be careful. Don't do anything to Jacob. But he catches up with him. He says, mate, you've deceived me by leaving. Mm. Like, this is the guy that's doing lots of deceiving.
Well, he tried to play the card. You didn't even let me kiss my grandkids goodbye kind of thing. This whole kind of sob story, really.
Anyway, they have this interaction. He says, and you've stolen my household gods. Jacob says, what? I don't know anything about this. You can go search.
The tents.
Go search the tents. Rachel hides the gods and lies. It's a weird moment. But, you know, he says to Laban, listen, I've been with you 20 years and you have just deceived me.
What's my crime against you? Kind of thing. Exactly.
There's no crime against me. Mm. You know, you've done the wrong thing by me, but God has still blessed me.
I'm on my way.
I'm leaving. So he's heading towards the land of Canaan. Mm. And of course, there's the issue of Esau isn't there.
Yes.
How are things with Esau? So he sends ahead to see, get a feel for how things are.
And the good news is there's this amazing welcome party.
There's a great welcome party. Esau finds out he's coming, comes out to meet him with 400 men. He's on his way with 400 men. That can only mean one thing.
Yeah. This is not a welcome party.
Yeah, this is not men and women with, you know, with tambourines and dancing. and no, this is 400 men. He's really angry.
And this is 20 years
this
later.
This is 20 years later. Yeah, this is a guy committed to a grudge.
Yeah.
So he's coming out with 400 men. In verse 7, it says, in great fear and distress, Jacob divided the people who are with him into two groups. He's going to minimize the damage. And then he does something, Stu, that he hasn't done before. He prays and he says to God, I'm unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you've shown to your servant. No kidding. But he prays that God would save him.
Now, he also knew Jacob just a little earlier in chapter 32. He made this sort of God's angels met with him. So
that's
there was
an
a
interesting
sense of,
verse there, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. It was as though he knew God was with him with what he saw, you know, the ladder perhaps, you know, a reflection back on that. And he was clearly aware somehow that there was two camps in a sense, the camp of angels that were traveling with him and looking after him and obviously his camp.
Yeah, it's a random mention in chapter 32, verse 1. Jacob also went on his way and the angels of God met him. Mm. This is just, as you say, it's a link back to the, you know, ladder of angels because he's going to have an encounter
with one of these guys.
And the fact that we're told this is important because it does put in context what's going to happen next because he sends the party ahead.
Yes.
He's left on his own. You know, in a sense, justice is coming for him. this is his just deserts is bearing down upon him. And it's in this context, as he's by this river, that we're told he was left alone and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. It's the weirdest
story. It is a very weird story.
Now, weird stories, Stu, are always important, very often very theologically important. So the man wrestles with him, takes hold of him. It's interesting. We sort of know this is the angel of the Lord. This is God in some mysterious incarnate form, as Jacob recognizes later on. But it's interesting that the man saw that he could not overpower him, and yet he just touches his hip and he wrenches his hip. In one sense, he has complete power over Jacob, but in another sense, he allows himself to be overpowered because Jacob keeps holding on and won't let go. The man says, "Let me go." And he says, "I'll not let go until you bless me." Jacob's worked out that this is
one of the angels.
This is a messenger of God.
Yeah.
And then there's a very interesting interaction.
Yes.
What's your name? And why would he ask that? Because his name's Jacob and it means deceiver.
Yeah.
In other words, you don't deserve blessing, but I'm going to change your name. Mm. And that's important because it's a change of identity, essentially. And your name from this point is going to be Israel, because you've struggled with God and with humans and have overcome. He says, "Tell me your name."
Jacob then asks.
He replies, "Why do you?" In other words, you're treading on holy ground here. Like, this is, we're going to leave it there. But he blesses him. Jacob recognized, because he calls the place Peniel. He says, "Because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." So this story, Steve, you know, and there's so much discussion about this story, but isn't it interesting that God, he's attacked, as it were. There's one other, I wonder if you can think of a story where, of another character that's in some senses gets attacked by God. I'm thinking of Moses. Remember, Moses is coming back to Egypt, and he's obeying God because he hadn't circumcised his sons, and his wife actually circumcises his sons. And I mean, they're just interesting moments. Mm. It's not, you know, attacking in, you know, malicious attack here, but there's a sense here that these people, they don't deserve what they're getting. What they are worthy of is judgment. And I think this wrestle here is somewhat indicative of the fact that this comes about through a struggle in a way. There's a relational element. There's a beautiful relational element to this. I mean, God takes hold in this really rough way, takes hold of Jacob, so that Jacob takes hold of him and ends up being blessed because he holds on to God and won't let go. And you can't help but think that God is taking hold of Jacob roughly so that Jacob never lets go of God again. The idea of wrestling with God, I mean, I think of the Psalms and, you know, these Psalms of complaint and lament. It feels like them wrestling with God, doesn't it?
"Hey, God, you said."
Yeah, that's
this
right.
"This is what seems to be happening."
And this becomes the nation.
Yeah, and this is what happening here. Jacob, basically, he's expecting to be annihilated by these 400 men coming and his family coming towards him. He finds himself wrestling with God. And in a sense, as you say, potentially that struggle becomes part of the cry out for the promise he knows he has. You know, how's this going to work?
And you can't help but feel that this somewhat pictures the whole story so far. Like, God has taken hold of people, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, like a parent would take hold of, you know, a child that's kicking and screaming until the child
calms down
and returns the embrace. Mm. And there's something beautiful about this moment in this beautiful symbolic way depicts everything that's happened so far.
Yes.
And then the nation get their name from. This is how it works. "You are mine because I have taken hold of you despite you." That's the wrestle, right? Yeah. "And I've taken hold of you so that you would take hold of me and not let go until I bless you." Oh, it's just a beautiful picture, I think.
It is.
So when Esau finally turns up, rather than coming and attacking his brother, that something significant has changed. No, I don't think there's any doubt in the text that he was coming to attack his brother.
Yep.
But when he turns up, he comes and embraces his brother.
Throws
his arms around him. He says, let's go back and live together. Jacob's thinking, oh, I don't know. I mean, again, lapse of faith. He's still pretty afraid of his brother. He doesn't completely trust, you know, Esau's sort of motives here. But I think genuinely God has brought about a change of heart in Esau. Yeah.
But you can understand that. I mean, 1 minute ago, it seemed like he was coming to kill him. And then all of a sudden, and because you know, I know Jacob's not Jacob anymore, but
yeah.
because he was a deceiver, he's thinking, oh, am I being tricked
yeah.
here?
Yeah, Jacob doesn't, he's not an angel from this point on.
No.
By no yeah. means is he, you know, he's, but it is moving forwards and, you know, he goes off and lives in a separate space to Esau. But significantly, Stu, both Jacob and Esau from this point are blessed. They are both blessed, right? Esau, yes. It's interesting to note, and you see this when we go down to Esau's descendants, you know, it says that God blessed them both so much that they had to move apart to have room for everything that God gave them. And it says that about them both together. Mm. And I think this is important because Esau gains from blessing his brother, because remember, the covenant is those who bless you, I will bless.
Yes.
And those who curse you, I will curse. So rather than killing his brother, you know, essentially cursing his brother, that's change, and he blesses his brother.
Mm.
And so as a result, Esau is blessed because he blesses his brother. Now, Esau
later,
is going to become the Edomites, right?
Right.
And that's not always going to be the case. Mm. The Edom is going to curse them and be cursed. But that's later on in the story. The next story, Stu, is a strange one. We get this story of Dinah who goes out. It's a weird account because we're told that she goes out to visit the women of the land. No one's really doing the right thing in this story. Now, this doesn't mean that she's to blame.
No, but it's an odd.
But, yeah, but everyone in this story is not behaving well. That's the point.
Yes.
So something terrible happens. She's Shechem, who's the son of the ruler in the area. He sees her, he takes her and he rapes her. And this is a terrible, terrible thing. Jacob, his response to this is really lackluster. His sons, I think, are more concerned about this. Remember, she's the daughter of Leah. So does he really care?
It's a bit of a transactional thing.
He doesn't seem to,
he
just doesn't seem to care. Doesn't seem to care about Leah or her children very much, because he very much favors Joseph and Benjamin, we find out. So the sons,
Her brothers
are infuriated, incensed by this,
totally.
Right? Shechem falls in love with her and wants to marry her. So his dad comes in to negotiate with Jacob. Jacob's kind of okay with this. The brothers are thinking, this is just terrible. Like, there's no way. And remember, there's the problem here of intermarrying.
Well, Jacob's probably also a little bit worried about keeping peace with all the locals. He's just bought into this area.
Yeah.
He's trying to establish himself. It's like, I don't need to pick any fights right now, guys. You know.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to pay the price, you know, for Dinah to pay the price of that peace. But her brothers are like, no.
Yeah.
No.
And they're going to do something deceptive.
Yes.
So these are Jacob's sons.
Mm.
And now they are going to be working deception.
Mm.
So the deception thing is passed down to the next generation. They say, all right, do that, but you all have to get circumcised. They get circumcised while they're healing. They go and they attack and they kill them all.
Yes.
And this becomes an absolute, like, this is an atrocity, and everyone hears about this. Because in those days, to make an agreement and then go against it, that sort of deception in the context in the ancient world, you know, kill and rape and whatever, but deception, going against your word, going against your oath, that seems to really be the thing that has a moral stench to it beyond anything else. And so, you know, in the eyes of everyone, they've really done something. I mean, I know it was bad what happened to Dinah, but their response is so disproportionate.
Yes.
And
deceptive.
And deceptive. Yeah. And so they've made enemies of everyone.
Yes. So then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have brought trouble on me, making me odious to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. We are few in number. If they unite against me and attack me, I and my household will be destroyed. But then an interesting answer from them. But they answered, should we have treated our sister like a prostitute?
Yeah. Again, this is a story that's given a fair bit of space.
Mm.
I think part of this, because remember the intermarriage thing, Stu, is a big issue here.
Yes.
And that becomes a big issue later. The fact that they say at one point, if we intermarry, you know, with Jacob's family, we'll eventually take over them completely. You know, like that's, you know, Shechem and his people
were much bigger.
Yeah, they've got eyes on more than just Dinah, right?
Yes,
they're thinking, if we intermarry with these people, we're much more powerful than them. We'll absorb them into ourselves.
Mm.
So you can't help feel there's something here that just portends what's going to happen later on with Israel being in the land and oppressed by intermarrying with the people and then being oppressed by the people. You know, the fact that she's raped, you set up this fraught relationship with the people in the land. It doesn't excuse anything that, you know, as I said, everyone's behaving badly here. But these stories, they do serve to just preempt the sorts of relationships that are going to exist up in the future. I think there's something like that going on here. But look, despite all of this, right, despite behaving badly, they're still blessed, Sue.
Yes,
I mean,
yeah.
They've done the wrong thing, but God is still blessing them.
So chapter 35, God speaks again to Jacob, get up, go to Bethel and settle there. Build an altar there to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau.
Yeah, so this is, he's got to fulfill it. He said he would go back there.
Yes.
So this is, remember, this is a sacred space for Jacob. So he says to his household, interestingly,
yes,
get rid of the foreign gods you have with you and purify yourselves and change your clothes.
Yeah.
You know, because we're going to this Bethel place. I mean, the fact that his family have these foreign gods is slightly disturbing. But again, this is people behaving badly.
Yeah. But this is quite a big group of people now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's we're not just talking about half a dozen
people. And they've come from up in Haran as well. So, steeped in idolatry.
And Rachel may still have the idols
that she took,
or Leah.
Because we haven't heard the end of those household idols either. So that's where they're getting rid of them and others here.
So the people obeyed. They gave everything to Jacob. He hid them under an oak tree at Shechem.
Yep.
When they set out, a terror from God came over the cities around them, and they did not pursue Jacob's sons. And you can imagine why they were terrified. Based on what had just happened before.
Yeah.
So they came to Luz, which is now known as Bethel, in the land of Canaan. Jacob built an altar there and called the place God of Bethel because it was there that God had revealed himself to him.
So there's a coming back, isn't there? There's a sort of symmetry to this story. He comes back to where he started and he acknowledges that everything that God said to him, it's come about. God reaffirms his change of name, reaffirms the promise to him. And it's a beautiful ending to the story. It's not really the end of the story of Jacob. There's more of Jacob, but it's a beautiful ending to this part of the story. Because then after this, we have the story of the deaths of Rachel and Isaac. And then we get this bit about Esau's descendants, which is important because the text wants to show that, like with Ishmael, we had that little cul-de-sac story about Ishmael. We've got the same thing here about Esau's descendants. And it says in verse 7, their possessions were too great. This is both Esau and Jacob.
Yep.
Their possessions were too great for them to remain together. The land where they were staying could not support them both because of their livestock. So God blesses them both.
Yeah.
And so this is showing God's faithfulness. And interestingly, this story ends with quite a long section about Esau and who they become. They become the rulers of Eden.
And we kind of skipped over Israel's sons, Jacob, who was renamed Israel, because they are essentially the 12 tribes.
That's right. Yeah.
Of Israel.
They're the 12 tribes of Israel. But the bit about the rulers of Edom, again, this is, there's still blessing for him. There's still blessing for him from God. Even though Jacob took the blessing, yet God still blesses him. You know, rulers coming from you, a lowly herds, you know, lowly shepherd, the fact that rulers would come from you is quite a, that's meant to signal quite a remarkable blessing. That's a remarkable thing, that a lowly shepherd would become the father of rulers in the future. Mm. So, you know, we see God's blessing to Esau. But of course, the story is going to follow Jacob and the sons of Jacob. So throughout this, Stu, in summary, you know, this is a story of people behaving badly, but God being good in the midst of people behaving badly. And again, we should take so much comfort from this because through our mistakes, through our regrets, everyone makes mistakes. Everyone has regrets. Everyone thinks, oh, will God keep blessing me? Is God going to discard me now? No, he doesn't. God is faithful to his promise and he will follow through.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.